Welcome to Books and Ideas Audio, a presentation of the Vancouver Writers' Fest. The Vancouver Writers' Fest connects people to exceptional books, ideas, and dialogue through year-round programming that ignites a passion for words and the world around us. We carry out our work on the unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples. This month, we're thrilled to share this event with number one New York Times bestselling author Celeste Ng, in conversation with J.L. Richardson, the Executive Director of the Festival of Literary Diversity. Celeste joined us to discuss her latest novel, Our Missing Hearts, which was named a Best Book of the Year by Time Magazine, The Washington Post, NPR, The LA Times, and more. This event was recorded live at our annual festival on October 19th, 2023. As always, we'd like to thank our public sector funders, without whom we couldn't do our work. The Government of Canada, the Canada Council for the Arts, the Government of BC, the BC Arts Council, the City of Vancouver, and CMHC Granville Island.
Good evening, everyone. My name is J.L. Richardson. I am the Executive Director of the Festival of Literary Diversity in Brampton. And I am also an author who loves books, who loves politics and politics in books, especially novels. So I'm very excited about this conversation. Welcome to Celeste Ng in conversation with yours truly. So now I'm going to introduce you to Celeste. You probably already know she's amazing. She's the author of three novels, all of which have been New York Times bestsellers. Everything I Never Told You, Little Fires Everywhere, All Our Missing Hearts. I came across Celeste's book when I read Little Fires Everywhere, and it remains one of my favorite novels of all times. So when Our Missing Hearts came out, I was ready. When they asked me to do this interview, I was ready. I tried to be very calm. I tried to appear calm backstage. I'm going to try to appear calm for the next hour. And then I give myself permission to just lose it a little bit. I'm going to actually read the book jacket before I bring Celeste out, because for those of you who don't know, this book, we're going to talk a lot about the book and about the content. And if you haven't read it, I'm going to try not to do any spoilers. We're going to try. But I think it's really helpful to just understand what the story covers. And so I'll just do a quick little reading in the back, and then Celeste will come out. So 12-year-old Bird Gardner lives a quiet existence with his loving father, a former linguist who now shelves books in a university library. His mother, Margaret, a Chinese-American poet, left without a trace when he was 9 years old. He doesn't know what happened to her, only that her books have been banned. And he resents that she cared more about her work than about him. Then one day, Bird receives a mysterious letter containing only a cryptic drawing. And soon, he is pulled into a quest to find her. His journey will take him back to the many folk tales she poured into his head as a child, through the ranks of an underground network of heroic librarians, and finally to New York City, where he will learn the truth about what happened to his mother and what the future holds for them both. Our Missing Hearts is an old story made new of the ways supposedly civilized communities can ignore the most searing injustice. It's about the lessons and legacies we pass on to our children and the power of art to create change. Ladies and gentlemen, and everyone who is here, please join me in welcoming Celeste Ng to her first Vancouver event.
Hi. Thank you all so much for coming. Thank you for supporting the Writers Festival and books. Thank you, J.O., for that amazing introduction.
Okay, this is me playing it cool, right? I got this. So, huge fan. I wanted to start by talking about the timing of this book. This book came out in 2022, but I'm wondering a little bit, if you could give us a little bit of context about how it began, because I think we can see
There's some parallels.
There's some parallels to what life was like at a certain time. I'm just curious, when you decided to write this book, what that sort of looked like.
Yeah. It's funny you say when I decided to write the book, because I was trying for a long time actually not to write the book. I wasn't sure that I knew how. I got the idea for the book first soon after I finished writing Little Fires Everywhere. That book, if any of you have read it, features an artistic mother, and her daughter is very much in support of her mother's art, and it causes her a lot of trouble in the book. And I started thinking, what if there was an artistic mother and her child didn't really understand why the mother felt so compelled to make this art or to take these stances or to do certain things? And that was the seed of this story. It was a very, you know, sort of small mother-son story. And I was thinking a lot about that relationship. And at this point, the 2016 election happened in the US, and the world started to feel very dark. And I wasn't sure that I wanted to write the story that was starting to develop in my mind, which in some ways was about a mother and son being separated. And so I put the book away for a while. And I started working on something else, and I kept taking this book out and kind of poking it and then like putting it back in the drawer. And it wasn't until 2020 when COVID arrived that I really felt like this was a book that I needed to write. Mm. I realized a lot of it was about many of the feelings that I was having during those early days of lockdown, of being isolated, of being unsure about where the world was going, about trying to figure out what to tell my kid mm-hmm. about the world that we were in. And so it was really during the pandemic that I sat down and this book became what it is.
Mm. I find it so fascinating that this one is dystopic. I think people, it is categorized in the dystopian realm. Yeah,
it is. Although I kind of always feel like saying like, how dystopian is it really? And we can talk about that more.
Well, let's talk about that.
Yeah.
Because it's funny, when I actually read Little Fires Everywhere, I thought that was dystopic. Like when I started reading about the homeowners association and like this, I was like, this is made up, right? This is like an invented world. I now recently moved to Florida where I live in a homeowners association. I was like, oh, I get it in a different way.
Yeah.
And so for this one, do you see it as dystopia? Like, how does that framing work for you?
I think of it as, it's not exactly our world, but it's our world maybe like 2 degrees off, or it's maybe our world as it might be in about like 15 to 20 minutes.
Yeah.
I will say that in the time since the book came out last fall and now, we've gotten closer to this in the United States, even though I was hoping that the book would become less and less like reality. Reality is quickly moving in that direction.
Mm. And did the idea, at least when you were writing it, does dystopia give you some freedom, some space to do things that makes it easier? Does it make it harder? Because I feel like having written a dystopia, like that world building piece can sometimes be a blessing and a gift and sometimes a great curse.
That's exactly it. It's both. I'd never written anything that wasn't sort of strictly realistic before. And I was terrified. I didn't know how to do it. I read lots of different genres, but I'd never written something like that myself. But this book felt like it needed that because it like you say, it gave me a little bit of space, kind of like elbow room, I think of it, to what if, which is what I think fiction writers do a lot, to say, well, what if this happened? What if that happened? If you're writing in a setting that's strictly realistic, immediately reality starts kind of coming in and saying, no, that doesn't happen. No, that's not going to happen. That's not really a place. Mm. If you allow yourself to say, this is not our world, suddenly there's a freedom in which you can do things. And it also allows you, I think, in some ways, to look a little more closely at your own world in a weird way. It's like how you can always see what the problem in somebody else's relationship is, but it's really hard to see that in your own.
I feel attacked. Like, I feel attacked.
You know, you see your friend and you're like, nah, I see the problem there. But you can't see it in your own. I think a similar thing happens with literature that is set in another world, whether it's fantasy, whether it's science fiction, whether it's dystopian, however you want to classify it. It's a little bit easier to see those problems when you've got a little bit of psychic distance from them.
Yeah. I want to help the audience even understand a little bit, for those of you who haven't read it yet, about what makes it dystopic and the places where we're like very close. Like, contemporary adjacent. I feel like there's a line and you're just like a little bit left of it in dystopia, but so close it's scary. And so one of the groups, well, the main group that's you know, sort of the dystopic element that's most obvious from the beginning is PACT, mm-hmm. which stands for, it's P-A-C-T, and it's an acronym that stands for Preserving American Culture and Traditions. So it's this organization that is imposing itself all over the place.
And you can hear from the hum.
You're like, is that real? It's like the HOA. Is that a thing?
Yeah, but you can imagine immediately, it's PACT is a series of laws that are they say to people, it's illegal to do certain things that are deemed un-American. Mm. You know, you have to report things that you find to be un-American. If you see this kind of if you see something, say something kind of idea, and you can tell immediately ways in which this law might be turned against certain groups, mm-hmm. right? And that's exactly what happens in the novel.
How early in the process did those laws and that vision kind of come into play?
Pretty early. And I honestly don't know exactly why. That's probably something I should take up with my therapist. I think in part, it came from me thinking a lot about what it means and also what it feels like to be an East Asian woman in America. As I said, I started getting this idea right around the time of the 2016 election, and there were some pretty awful things being said, and it has not greatly improved. Mm. But I was thinking a lot sort of about what it meant for me to be an American. I was born in Pittsburgh, grew up in the Midwest, but I think to a lot of people, when they look at me, they do not see an American, mm-hmm. right? There's a sense of otherness. And that's something I've been aware of for my whole life. And I was really thinking about it in the context of this story. Mm-hmm. And so that idea that PACT in this novel, these laws are sort of being turned against Asian Americans. China is being blamed for a lot of the sort of like economic and social problems that they've had, and it's been scapegoated in the novel. Mm. I feel like it's important to say in the novel at this point. But I was thinking, like, you know, there's a lot of anti-Asian sentiment happening in my country right now. What if that were the law of the land, right? So I had that idea very early, and that's part of why I shied away from writing this novel for a long time. It's scary to think about that. Mm.
One of the things that you do in the opening and in the beginning half of the book is it really centers around Bird, mm-hmm. and around Bird's discoveries about his mom and also his friend Sadie. What made you choose a young narrator, not a young narrator, but the young main character to kind of focus in on, especially in that first half?
Yeah. Bird is 12 at the beginning of the novel, and his mother left the family 3 years before, so he was 9, so quite young. And I realized early on that this novel, in some ways, was going to be about an awakening mm-hmm. for him. And I think there's something about that age, 12, where you're still a child, but you are sort of starting to tiptoe towards adulthood. You're starting to get a sense of sort of how the world around you works. At that age, I think when you're a child, your world is very small. You know, if you're lucky, you've got a family life, and you think that's what the world is. And it's when you get older that you start to realize, oh, there's a lot of other families out there, and they do things differently than my family does. And there's a lot of history out there that I didn't know about, but that is still kind of reverberating into my life. And that's also the time where I think for many of us, you start to realize that your parents are actual people, and that they have a life outside of you, and maybe they always had a life outside of you. And, you know, that kind of shifts your frame of who they are. It's an age where you know, if you've been looking at the world, you think it's this big, and then you realize that actually there's all this other canvas outside of that frame. And so it felt right to tell the story from Bird's eyes, because he's at that age where he's realizing sort of how big the world is and how big it works, and the reader gets to go on that journey with him and slowly discover what's out there on that canvas.
It's always so great too. It's great to, in a dystopia, I think it's really nice to be able to enter from a child's eyes, because they're looking at it and the reader is kind of like, unknown. This is an unknown world for them too. And I loved the way Bird and Sadie showed us what's dystopian, but also what is normal, what's their world. I was curious, I'm always curious about the writing process, yeah, and whether this novel was always the way it is now, or whether there were shifts in the shape it took, the way the story was told, that kind of changed as you were working or thinking about it.
It's funny to think back on that, because when I originally envisioned the story, I thought that it would sort of have three parts, and the first part would focus on Bird, and the second part would focus on his mother, and the third part would focus on both of them together. And then I took a very long meandering path in which I tried many other things, and at the end, what I ended up with was a novel that has three parts, and the first part's about Bird, and the second part is his mother, and the third part is about sort of the two of them together. I guess the lesson is that I should trust my own instincts more. Mm. But for me, that's always part of the writing process, is sort of figuring out what shape the thing needs to be. It's a little like being an archaeologist. You're kind of digging something up and you're figuring out how to stick all these pieces together in a way that makes a cohesive whole.
Mm. And was this process similar or different from your previous novels, given that those were more contemporary?
Every one of them has been different. I guess this is, I only have one kid, but I'm assuming that if I had more than one kid, I would have experienced the same thing, where each one of them is very different from the other. Mm. And it's a little depressing, because what that says to me is that, you know, as I start to write the next book, I'm also going to have to basically reinvent the wheel for every book. But for me, books always start off with a question. There's always something that I don't understand. How did this character get to be this way? How did they get into this situation? You know, why are they like this? Mm-hmm. And writing the book for me is the process of figuring out the answers to those questions. And so there's always a lot of kind of digging, like sort of psychological digging, for me to find the shape of the book.
I'm going to tell you, I feel like we are meant to be besties. I don't know. I don't know if Celeste is feeling
this. We're already kind of bonding backstage.
We're bonding backstage. We have tattoos in the exact same spot. Your answer right there is the exact same reason that I write. There are so many parallels between our two books that I won't get into, but we're besties. Just tell everyone, okay?
Yes.
Okay. So one of the things that I actually found interesting as well, and it's a parallel between a dystopian novel that I wrote, was this element of poetry. And I was so fascinated when I was reading the book, and Margaret's a poet, and this is her profession. It's also part of the reason that she is, what is happening to her is happening to her. I told you I would not spoil things. I told you. And I was curious about this choice, because as a writer, there's so many things she could have written. You know, she could have been a journalist, could have been a novelist, could have been, mm-hmm. but it's poetry that you chose. And I was curious about why.
Part of it is because I feel like there's something like a little twee about a fiction writer writing about a fiction writer. It gets to like that M.C. Escher drawing where the hands are like drawing each other. But part of it also is just because I really love poetry. I wanted to be a poet when I was younger. And then my poems kept getting longer and more narrative. And I realized that maybe that wasn't the right genre for me. But I really love poetry. I love the way poets think, and I love the way that a poem can kind of take one moment and kind of distill something really huge into that sort of like one little thing. Part of it is that during the pandemic, I was having a really hard time. I think like many of us, I was feeling very helpless and kind of useless. I kept thinking to myself that if I had gone to medical school, maybe I could be doing something right. I could be treating people. If I had gone and become a scientist, I could be working on a cure. I could be working on the vaccine. I could be doing something. And here I was in my office, like typing on my laptop, right? Yeah. It felt very inadequate. And what helped me get out of that funk was realizing that I was turning to art to kind of get myself through the day. I was reading one of my favorite poems every morning. And there was one that I liked so much, actually, it was so motivating to me that I typed it up and I hung it over my desk. Mm. I was listening to my favorite music. I was watching my favorite films. I was also watching a lot of dumb TV, but there was something about... We can talk about, we should discuss later, my son made me watch this show called Is It Cake?
Oh my gosh, yes, where they put the cakes out there.
Is exactly what it sounds like it's going to be, so I'm not pretending that's art exactly. but there's something about this, though, that I think art could take you out of that moment. It could give you, in its more serious ways, maybe not Is It Cake, but some of the poems or other things, they can remind you that the world can be really different. Mm-hmm. And that felt important to hold on to. And so when I started writing Margaret as a character, I was thinking about the ways that poetry can kind of speak to you, and it can speak across time. It can speak... It can speak at you kind of sideways. Mm-hmm. It's not like a polemic. It's not that, but that it can open up something for you. Mm-hmm. And it felt like the right art form for this woman who, again, I won't spoil anything, but who is seeing things in the world that she wants to draw attention to and talk about. And poetry felt like the right way for her to do that.
Mm-hmm. I love it. I have to ask, because the nosiness in me is like dying, what poem was the poem you hung on your wall?
I wasn't trying to be coy. It seemed like a weird like diversion to go on to. It's a poem by a woman named Muriel Rukeyser. I think it's unhelpfully titled like poem. but it begins, I lived in the first century of World Wars. And then the speaker of the poem goes on to talk about how she's trying to write, and she has all these devices, the radio, the television, the newspapers, that are giving her terrible headlines, and she can't stop thinking about them. She can't get to work. She's calling her friends, and they're also, as she puts it, more or less insane for the same reasons. Mm. And what eventually gets her to her desk and gets her writing is thinking about the people who are far away geographically or even in time, and the idea that they're speaking to each other across this distance, across this time, and that maybe these poems are lights for them the way that other works are lights for her. Mm-hmm. And so that really spoke to me in a way, to think about how a lot of times when you're writing, you don't know who's going to read it, but the hope is that it's going to reach somebody who needs to hear that, and that it's going to open something for them that will help them in whatever they're going through. Mm-hmm. And so I typed it up and I hung, it's actually still over my desk now. And periodically I look at it and try and keep that in mind.
I love that. I love it. I think someone described it. I think I'm quoting somebody else who talked about poetry being a uniquely portable magic.
Oh, I love that.
And the way that you're able to share it. It's why we love, I think, songs and lyrics so much, is because it's something you can actually share. I mean, the agony of reading an amazing book and then having to wait for someone else to read the whole thing so you can talk about it.
Yes.
Like, let's talk about that problem, please.
I'm a very fast reader. And so if I give books to like my husband or like my sister and I'm like, okay, you need to read this so we can talk about it, get on it. And they're not slow readers, but they don't read as fast as I do. So I'm like waiting. I'm like, how far through are you?
Yeah. Are you what part? Can we talk about this yet?
Yeah. Yes. Has this happened yet? Okay, forget I said that. Like, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I love the idea that poetry, when you find those poems that you can give someone, there's one I have about, he wrote it about his mom was passing away from cancer. Mm-hmm. And it was her life told backwards, essentially. Mm-hmm. And it was like this really, and every time I have a friend whose mom is sick or passing or a parent, it's the poem that I share with them, not to be morbid, but to remember like the journey that you've shared together. And like the way that poetry is able to do that is unlike anything else.
Yeah, there's something about it. I think, you know, poems are not always short, but that they are kind of distilled down, you know, in a way they're sort of this concentrated essence of whatever emotion or whatever thought the poet is doing. I really admire poets in that. And again, as a novelist, that seems kind of impossible to me that they can distill it. But there was an event in Massachusetts where they asked a bunch of different, they called it like leaders. And then also for some reason, like me and one other writer, but it was like the governor and like the attorney general and all these other people, and then like these two writers. But they asked us to come and share a poem that meant something to us. And to my surprise, everybody had one. And a lot of those people, like the attorney general of Massachusetts, could like recite those poems from memory. And so there's something about the idea that the poem, you know, you can kind of, like you say, you can kind of keep it inside you in a way that you can't always with a bigger piece of work. There's something lovely about that.
Something lovely. I'm just, grace. I want to talk a little bit about the library element, the books, and the banned books. This is I was fascinated how, you know, people talk all the time about how like authors predict the future, and it's really not. They just pay attention to things and then they elevate them and then they become more public too. Can you tell me a little bit about that interest in calling to attention, in focusing in on, in writing in the element of banned books and the power that these librarians have in the story?
Sure. So one of the things that happens in the book is that schools and libraries and other institutions are pressured to remove books, again, that are seen as un-American or that have un-American themes. And you can imagine, again, where this goes. Like you say, I'm not a psychic, but what happened was that I think I was imagining what might happen. I looked at a lot of times in history, in U.S. history and world history, in which essentially freedom of speech and sort of intellectual freedom was restricted, and book bans have always been part of that. And so I wrote that into the novel because that's what's happened before, and lo and behold, it seems to be happening again. Mm. I think as a writer, it's really important to me to say people should be able to access literature, right? That personally, but also as someone who is in a racial minority, somebody who's had an experience of being othered in my own society, it feels really important to say, actually, everybody needs to be able to see themselves in the pages of a book. You need to be able to find your stories. You need to know that you have stories and to have them be valued. And when books are taken away, you don't get to see that. And so for me also, it was a very sort of personal feeling of what happens if your stories are taken away from you, if you're no longer allowed to learn about them. Mm. And, as many of you probably know, the U.S. right now is in the middle of a lot of, struggles about what books are going to be allowed in schools, what books are going to be allowed in libraries, and all kinds of other things. And you moved to Florida, so you know all about this.
I know very much about this. one of my things about that is how has the book been received in those spaces, and how are librarians? Because it feels like the very type of book that would be banned, because it's speaking about books being banned. Have you come across any resistance to the work?
I haven't yet. Maybe they just haven't told me about it. Because sometimes, a lot of times when people ban books, sometimes they want to like trumpet it, but a lot of times they actually just want to take it away and not say anything. Mm. There was a librarian in a town in Florida called Flagler. I don't know where it is, but...
Oh, I know where Flagler is.
Do you know where Flagler is?
I just happened to... Anyways, there's a long story about why I know where Flagler, Florida is.
I admit that I did not know until I heard about this, but their town was busy sort of voting about whether or not their libraries were going to have to remove certain books, mostly having to do with Black history and LGBTQ populations. And at the town meeting at which they were to vote on one of these bans, the librarian got up and announced that their one Flagler, one Reed book was going to be Our Missing Hearts, which I very much appreciated. And I wrote to her and said, thank you for fighting this good fight. I hope that you can convince people. I don't know specifically of any places that it's been banned. I feel like feels inevitable at some point, because they're banning everything at this point. There was a book a picture book about a pink kitten who wants to be a unicorn. And that was banned. But nobody had read the book. Mm. It's called Kitty Corn. She makes a little unicorn horn for herself out of a piece of candy corn. And that's the state that we're in some places. So it's not great.
And on that note, I think one of the things that I was really affected by and something that I've been wrestling with in the books that I've been working on is this idea of activism. And we were talking a little bit about this backstage. And I'm curious if, as working on this novel, as you were thinking through book bans and other things that you're addressing through PACT and PACT laws, what you were questioning, because you say you always start with a question, what you were questioning, what kinds of answers you came across, if any, how was that unpacking of the question as you're writing, if that makes sense?
It does make sense. I think this is one of the questions that I asked myself a lot, certainly during the previous administration, but also now in a time where a lot of the problems that we're facing feel really almost overwhelming in scale. This question of what can one person do about any of these problems? Racism, climate change, right? Our political system, like long-standing disputes in the Middle East, they feel like such huge problems. And as one person, it feels hard to know, okay, what am I gonna do that's actually gonna make a difference? And that's something that I struggle with just on a personal level. But then I look at my kid and I think, well, I don't want to tell you that, you know what, the world is just really screwed. Like, just give up now. Like, nobody wants to raise their child that way. And I don't want to believe that either. So a lot of it is me trying to figure out that balance. That's part of what led me to read the book, to try and ask questions about, you know, can one person make a difference? Mm. Can art, generally speaking, make a difference, right? Or is it only sort of like, you know, through legislation and through, I don't know, you know, again, being a first responder, is that the only way? Or is there a space for what I do to actually make a difference? And then how do we try and give the next generation enough hope to keep going? Those were all the questions that I realized that I was asking in the novel. And they're the questions that Bird, the boy in the novel, is also trying to figure out. Mm. I don't know if I actually answered the question.
I was so fascinated by the answer, I lost track of what I asked. It's fine. I feel like that was great. I love asking authors about craft, about how they work, how they operate, where they work. What does writing look like for you? Like, where do you do it? How do you do it? How often? What's that process for you?
So I have a little office in my house. It's just like a spare bedroom. So I usually am writing there, but I do often go out to write. Like, I take my laptop to a coffee shop, or I have writing dates with friends. There is nothing like having another writer sitting across the table from you to provide accountability. It's like they're sitting there typing away and you're like, oh, they're writing, I better write too. And then later on you find out that they were thinking the same thing about you. Mm-hmm. For me, it's a lot of, I always need to have some kind of caffeinated beverage. So for me, like hot tea is my beverage of choice, or iced tea in the summer. And usually there's some kind of sugary snack involved as a self-bribe. Like, you know, you get, if you can write, you know, to the end of this page and you can eat another Swedish fish, get to another page, you can have another Swedish fish. Like, I'm all for self-bribery. But what, on a more serious note, what I do is every day I sit down and I start my work by rereading what I did the day before. It's a way of getting myself back into the story. It's a way of, kind of jogging my memory and giving me a little launching pad to go forward. And then I write, usually starting from when my son goes to school. So, you know, like 8:30 in the morning, I have until he comes home from school. So, you know, mid afternoon, if I can write that whole time, that's a really good work day. Mm-hmm. It's usually more, I've got about 3 solid hours of writing in me. And then the rest of the day is reading, is doing research, is answering emails, going for a walk. It's all the other stuff that doesn't feel like work, but that I realize actually always feeds the work, and then get up and do it again the next day. It's slow, slow progress.
And you talked about how when you wrote Little Fires Everywhere, that sort of led to this last novel. Did this last novel lead to something else?
I don't know yet. I don't mean to be coy. I'm in the stages of trying to figure out a new idea. I think it might be a book. I don't know what it is yet. There's always, for me, I'm figuring out what are the questions that I'm interested in. I'm doing research, which mostly means that I'm like borrowing a lot of really random books from the library because my brain puts those books into this project. Mm. And I don't know how, for example, like miniatures and historic house museums and the Opium War are all going to fit into this book. Mm. Those are some of the subjects that I have been reading about, but they're starting to click. Mm. I always visualize the process as sort of like an electromagnet. There's a certain point at which the electricity flicks on and the coils become magnetic, and then little pieces start flying in from other places to stick together. And when that moment starts happening, that's usually when I can sit down and actually get going. Mm. So I guess I'm in the process of flipping the switch.
Love it. I am going to move into a series of questions that have been on my mind for a little while, if you'll all indulge me. I wanted to ask about Little Fires Everywhere and the TV adaptation, yes. If it's okay.
Of course.
Am I obsessed with it? Yes, I am. Surprise, surprise. Actually, in our event yesterday, we were talking about how women are not often, it's not often seen as good to like be obsessed with topics and mm-hmm. to be sort of in the way that men are often allowed to be like obsessed with like a sports team or whatever. It's kind of,
cars.
And I'm like, cars, mm-hmm. I am obsessed with a lot of things. It's fine. This is also a little bit of a heads up that probably in the next 10, 15 minutes, we're going to turn it over to you all to ask some questions. So just if you have burning questions you've been waiting to ask, Celeste, prepare. So I watched the TV adaptation of Little Fires Everywhere, and I wanted to know a little bit about that process, yeah. What it was like for you, because I'll get to that and I'll let you answer that question and I'll let it lead
okay.
to a couple other questions.
It was really fun, yeah. Honestly. I don't know how I got so lucky as to get Reese Witherspoon and Kerry Washington to be in this show.
Yeah.
But I'm really grateful that they did it, and I really like what they did. Mm. I went into the process of making the adaptation with the idea that I wanted it to have space to grow into its own thing. Mm. The adaptations that I like the best as a viewer are the ones where it's clear that they got to play with the source material a little bit. It doesn't always have to be a faithful sort of beat for beat mm. adaptation. Mm. And I think it's better if it isn't, because film and the written word are two very different media. And what works on the page does not always work on the screen. I learned from this process that I write a lot of characters sitting and thinking and remembering stuff, and that doesn't translate well onto the screen. And so they would, you know, the wonderful screenwriters are like, well, we have to dramatize that because you can't just have them sitting there. Mm. So I didn't want to do any of the screenwriting. I don't really know how to do that. And I wanted people who did know how to do it to do it. Mm. But I got to read the scripts. I got to give them feedback on it. I got to go to sit in on the writer's room, which was super cool. Really fascinating to see how screenwriters think, really different from the way that I as a novelist think. I got to go visit the set, which was really cool. I got a little like cameo where they dressed me up like I was in the 90s, and I had fun.
In the actual, like if I go back, I can find you?
You can find me.
Oh.
Should I tell you where it is, or should I not tell you?
I'm going to message you if I can't find you, but I'm going to.
But it was really cool. Again, you know, as a writer, it's just kind of always cool to have new experiences, and I had never been on a film set. And so getting to watch people who do this professionally and watch and see what they do and see everything that happens, it gave me a huge appreciation for just the entire filmmaking industry. It's so collaborative. There are so many people who do all of these different things, who are lighting, who are changing the props, who are doing everything. In some ways, it's the complete opposite of what novelists do, because as a novelist, it's basically just you, at least in the early drafts. You can change the location. You can do whatever you want. You're controlling everything. Mm. And filmmaking is really different. It's really collaborative. And so there was a big room of writers, not just one, but a lot of different people with a lot of different experiences. And I think that makes the product richer. So it was a really cool experience to just watch that happen.
And I have to ask you, I had never seen this done before, like never seen this done where the novel is about the main character is East Asian. And then it's very overt that that, is that overt?
I actually didn't specify Mia's race in the novel. And it's been really interesting to hear different people sort of interpret her in different ways. But you're exactly right that in the series, she's played by Kerry Washington and she's a black woman. Yeah. And that actually, that was Reese Witherspoon's idea. She said, okay, I have this idea. It's a little change, so tell me what you think, but I'm thinking, what if we ask Kerry Washington to do this? And I loved it, first, because I think she's a great actress.
Yes.
But second, because what it told me was that this production was going to lean into exploring the issues that I wanted the book to explore, and they were going to do it in a different way. Mm. It would have been really easy for them to go, let's shy away from the issues of race in the book. And instead, they were like, let's lean into that. Mia's not black in the novel, partly because I was like, I don't want to pretend like I know what a black woman's experience in America is, yeah. right? I can imagine parts of it, but I know that I don't know that. Yeah. But Kerry Washington can portray that. Yeah. And there are, you know, I think 4 black women in this group of 7 writers, they can speak to that experience. And so this adaptation has an opportunity to explore those questions from an angle that the book could not. And so I loved that those things can be in dialogue with each other now.
Yeah. Yeah. And so was it Kerry Washington and then Mia became black, or was it like, we want Mia to be black and let's get Kerry Washington?
I don't know actually, but I feel like those two things kind of came in together.
Yes.
And whichever, whether the chicken or the egg came first, whichever one of those is the chicken, whichever is the egg, I love that it allowed them again to kind of look at this, from a different angle, you know, like if a story is like a little sculpture in a museum, you know, the book looks at it from one side, but the film adaptation is going to go and look at it from a different side, and you're going to get different angles of it, and you get a different perspective on this same story, depending on how it's told.
I remember when I turned it, well, I knew from the ads that Kerry Washington was in it, and I couldn't actually fathom initially, like, how is she in it? Who is she? So the series starts, and I'm like, I gotta be honest. The first episode, I was like, what is this? Something very different is happening. And by the end, I realized it is very different from the novel. It has a different effect. It has a different spin. It has a different turn. Mm-hmm. And I actually loved it, but I would tell people, you got to read the book and you got to watch the TV series, and don't get too attached to them being like twins.
Yeah.
They're more like cousins. You know?
I love that way of thinking.
Right? So you watch it and you learn different things. So for you watching it back, you're involved in the whole planning process. You're in the room with the writers at different points, but then you get to watch it. What was that like, seeing the story and then having a whole new element that probably wasn't at all a part of your writing process?
It was really surreal, but I think, it's a testament to what a good job they did that I was sitting on the couch with my husband. And like, at one point I like grabbed his arm and I was like, oh my God, what's going to happen? And he was like, this is true. And he was like, you wrote the book. Like you know, it's, and I was like, but I'm really caught up in the thing. I don't, you know, that sense of suspense was still there. I always like to say that I think that a good adaptation is sort of like a cover song in a way. Like you want to hear, you know, the melody, you know, you want to hear the words that you know, maybe a couple changes, but you actually don't want it to sound too much like the original. If it is, it's kind of disappointing. You want to hear the spin that the new band is putting on it. In a way, you want that suspense. It's like, ooh, what are they going to do with this, right? And so they did it for me anyway.
I love it. I mean, ultimately, it is the first time where I can say I love both of them. Like, I love both of them, but for very different reasons and very different ways. You know, I usually am like, I like the novel better than the film, or sometimes Hunger Games.
Sometimes
I like the film better than the books. don't tell her.
Okay, no one's hearing this.
So this was one where I felt like there were two existing works of art that really did two different things and some similar things.
I love
and,
that. I feel like that's what I wanted from the adaptation. I wanted it to get to be its own thing, and I wanted it to be its own work of art, essentially.
Mm-hmm. So I want to talk about like where you go from here, because I think you have talked about politics. All your books have some element of political.
I'm so glad to hear you say that, because like a lot of, I think I'd heard from a number of reviewers and even some readers where they're like, well, this one's really political. And I was like, did you not think the first two were?
Yeah.
But it's true. What we think of as politics, yeah. I think is, sometimes it's not, that's a very small subset of what politics actually is. I mean, for me, again, as an Asian American woman, you know, I'm a child of immigrants, I, you know, whatever, all the different sort of concentric or not concentric, but Venn diagram circles that I'm in, my existence is political. Yeah. Like there isn't any way of getting around that. So anything I write, I think is going to be political, but this book for some reason struck people as.
And did you political. See that? Did you see in the response from people like this, people reacting in a way that like was it off-putting? Were people like, not this, give me something lighter?
I don't know. I think that there were a lot of people who were like, I want to read something that's dark. And I was like, well, it does go to dark places, but for me, it is a book that is really about hope. Mm-hmm. It was a book that I wrote while I was trying to figure out how do you hold on to hope when it feels like the world is very rapidly falling apart? Mm-hmm. You know, what do you do about that, especially if you have a stake in the next generation? Mm. How do you manage to balance that feeling of like creeping despair that you have on the one hand and the feeling of optimism that you want to have for the next generation? So some people did. I've been always really happy when people say, well, I thought I wasn't going to like it, but then I did. I'm like, great. That's
woo.
I was like, I'm really glad to hear that. And it's okay if you don't. It's not, you know, no book is for everybody. But I do think the first two novels for me also were political as well.
Yeah. I think a lot of people, hope looks different.
Yes.
And I think you have to, especially when you're not from a marginalized community, even just hearing about the lives of people from marginalized communities can feel dark.
Yeah.
And understanding that that's just existence. That's just life. It's baseline. And seeing that even in those circumstances, we all find hope.
Yeah.
And it's your job, I think, as the reader to understand what hope looks like for you and how to find it in stories that may seem hopeless.
Oh,
because it's
so
often
well
like your lens that's making it hopeless.
That's
and not
so
the
well
actual
put.
Characters. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I interrupted your question.
No. I was just babbling for that. But there was something I was going to say. Do I remember what
you started
I was
off with saying, where do I go from here? And I kind of
oh, yes,
stalled
yes,
because
yes.
I was like, where I don't
go?
Know.
So my question is, do you want to dial up the politics? Does this make you want to say like more? Or is it, I'm going to like hide it? Or like, does it change how you approach, given that you've written things where people didn't see them as political, and this one is very overtly and being received more, perhaps more overtly as political, does that change how you're going to approach the next thing?
I don't think it does, actually, because I didn't, as weird as it sounds, I didn't do any of that on purpose, if that makes sense. Like, I think the first, you know, my first two books were, you know, were political in my mind because I was talking about what it means to be other in a community, or, you know, big questions about what does it mean to be seen as a good mother, or, you know, all of these sort of large scale questions. For me, those are political questions. I like the idea of like kind of like hiding it in there on purpose. It makes me think of like there was like a period of time where there were cookbooks coming out for parents where they wanted to like put spinach in the broccoli or in the brownies.
I have one of
where
those
they're like
works.
How do you get your kids to eat vegetables? Yeah. So blend the spinach and then like put it in the brownie and then like feed it to your child. Oh. I kind of love that idea in some ways of being like you're going to learn something, but it's going to be secret. Yeah. But for me, it's always about the story first, honestly. In this book as well, you know, I didn't set out to write a political book, but the story that I realized I wanted to tell was touching on issues of politics about, you know, how do we handle societal crises as individuals, or what does it mean if the government is involved in deciding who counts as being a good parent, right? Those are political questions. But for me, I come at them through story, always. It's always about character for me. And then the story comes from there. So we'll have to see what happens with the next book.
I'll be ready.
It comes in.
We lined up at the bookstore on the first day. I am going to wrap things up there. So please, let's give a big round of applause for Celeste.
Thank you all for coming. Thank you. And thank you, JL.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Books and Ideas Audio, a presentation of the Vancouver Writers Fest. To hear more events like this one and view our upcoming events, visit our website at writersfest.bc.ca.